is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Beersmith Podcast number 40. Got a great show for you today. We're going to talk a little bit about Pilsner beers. Just a quick reminder, Beersmith 2.1 is out, and also our new Beersmith recipe site, which is at beersmithrecipes.com. I recommend you visit both those and check them out. Again, go to beersmith.com or beersmithrecipes.com if you want to see the new recipe site. We've got over 3,000 members as of this morning, and growing rapidly just in the first week and a half, 2 weeks. So we're really happy with that site. And now, without further ado, let's go into this week's episode. Today on the show, I have Eric Schmid, who is the Brewmeister Homebrew Shop with locations in Folsom, California and Roseville, California. You can also find him online at shopbrewmeister.com, his new website. He is a 2002 graduate of the American Brewers Guild, and it's great to have him on the show. How are you doing, Eric?
I'm great. Thanks, Brad. I'm happy to be on.
Congratulations on your second store.
Thank you. It's been a lot of work and a lot of effort, and we pulled it off, so we're very happy.
Had a big grand opening there in Roseville, California for the second store this weekend.
Yep, and it went great. So not sweating as much as I was last week.
I know how that is. I just launched a new version of Beersmith, so I went through the same sort of, is it going to go well? How's it going to go?
Yeah.
And then we launched a new recipe site as well, beersmithrecipes.com.
I've checked it out. It's great.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. So today's topic is Pilsners, which of course is the most popular beer style actually in the world today, and certainly the most popular here in the United States. So I was wondering if you could share a few words about the Pilsner beer style and, kind of what makes it unique.
Well, it's one of my favorite styles to brew and drink. It's kind of hard to find true original Pilsner styles here in the U.S. I mean, get Pilsner or Kell and some of those, but I kind of came across it when my wife and I first got married, and we did a lot of traveling in Europe. And what I think is unique about the style is it's very light in color, makes it attractive to a lot of people just visually. But if you taste a real good Bohemian style Pilsner, it reminds you a lot of some of the early American style IPAs, where it's very hop oriented. Good balance. I just think it's a great all-around beer. It's a good beer to drink in warm weather. It's a good beer to drink in the winters. And I think it's kind of an underappreciated style here in the U.S.
Yeah, I know some homebrewers kind of malign Pilsners, but like you said, if you get a good one overseas, they're fantastic.
Yeah, I think say flavorless beers that a lot of people, the homebrewers, kind of shun here in the U.S., Coors and Bud and those types of things. The Americans adapted the Pilsner style and started brewing it with 6-row instead of 2-row and adding things like corn and rice to it because that's what was available to here when they settled over here. But that's not really how the style started, and it doesn't, I don't believe, represent the German and Bohemian style Pilsners, which are a lot more flavorful. And when you see what's going on in the U.S. with IPAs these days, I really think that the true classic Bohemian German Pilsners with their hopping levels in the 30s and 40s are something I think people can learn to appreciate again.
Well, I mean, it's a good topic to talk about. The Pilsner is one of the few beers where we have a really well-defined history for it. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of Pilsner?
Yeah, it doesn't date back as far as a lot of the ale beer styles, because refrigeration was kind of a problem until the mid-1800s. And once they were able to control fermentation, kind of the Industrial Revolution time, Pilsners became more popular and were actually started to brew in Czechoslovakia. And what was really cool about it is that these ales were fermented because that's kind of what the environmental temperatures would allow them to be fermented, but it created a lot of ester and unique flavors to ales. And the nice thing about Pilsners and the lager yeast is that it's very clean fermenting, and you can really have the beer stand on its malt and its hop merits and not have a whole lot of flavor derived from, you know, a fermentation temperature and an ale type of yeast.
Now, you know, Pilsen, Czechoslovakia, which is where it originated, is very close to Bavaria, and it's kind of sandwiched in between, you know, Vienna, Bavaria, kind of right in the middle there. You know, what role did that play in development of the style?
Well, Pilsen has very soft water, and that's characteristics of the Bohemian style Pilsners, is that classically made with really soft water. It helps to allow the hops to stand on their own. Bavaria kind of adopted their own version of Pilsner beers, which is a little less hopped and would ferment a little drier based on the conditions in and around Germany. It just the style adapted a little bit in Germany. And, you know, with the German purity law that came into play, the Reinheitsgebot, or I don't know if I say that correctly or not. You know, it fit right in with that, in that you're only brewing with the, you know, kind of the Germany-defined ingredients that go into beer with, you know, malt, water, yeast, and hops.
Let's dive into actually brewing Pilsner. Let's start with the grain bill. What's a good grain bill for, say, a European Pilsner?
Well, the text will tell you, you know, 100% Pilsner malt, if you want to do it the way they originally did. You know, a lot of it has to do with what's available to you, especially here in the U.S. You know, a Pilsner should be brewed, if you're trying to brew it to that original style, with the Monrovian style barley that's really lightly malted. It's not kilned for a long time, and hence why it has such a light color. You can also buy, I think Weyermann actually has a really nice Bohemian style Pilsner malt that's a little bit under modified, so it's actually meant to be decoction mashed. So it really depends, you know, how you brew it depends on the type of ingredients you start with. Personally, I don't really have time in my days anymore to do decoction mashes. I don't have 10 hours to spend. I've done them. I really liked kind of the melanoidins and some of the caramel flavors that came from them. But my wife and I have a four-year-old. I have two shops to run. And so my brew days, I really try to keep as short as possible. The malts that are available to us now versus, you know, in the 1800s and early 1900s, where I don't think malting techniques were quite as sophisticated. The malts that are available now are much better modified, and they don't need necessarily to go through the different temperature ranges and rests that the decoction and step mashes provide. So, you know, I like to start with a well-modified Pilsner malt of German origin. You know, we carry Best malt here. We also use some Weyermann German pills. I think both of those are perfect for that kind of style. I've done them with 100% Pilsner. I sometimes like to add a little bit of Munich malt, maybe 2 or 3% of the grist. I've also in the past added some melanoidin malt to kind of mimic that, decoction style, mash. And, you know, I brewed one today and I actually put in a little bit of honey malt, just to kind of give it a little bit more of a sweet, toasty kind of backbone. But, you know, if you're really brewing it to style, you should start with 100% Pilsner malt for sure.
Now, what does a melanoidin do for you?
Melanoidin just kind of rounds it out, gives you a little bit of a slight caramel flavor. Mm-hmm. It just gives you kind of that flavor that's created from either the flame on the bottom of the kettle or the... kind of the carbonization or the caramelization that goes on when you decoction mash, and you're actually bringing part of the mash out and bring it to a boil in the kettle. You know, when you're boiling a pretty thick oatmeal style grain mash in a kettle, it tends to burn a little bit, and that the flavor you get, that's kind of a melanoidin type of flavor.
And that's what, I mean, that's what was traditionally done, right?
That's what's traditionally done,
and the reason was because they were under modified, I assume, right?
Right. It was essentially an extension of the malting process, so they had to continue with the malting process. They would come in and you know, right around 100 degrees, and do kind of an acid rest, and then they'd pull a third of it out, bring it to a boil, add it back, and in doing so, it would raise it up in the 120 degree range, and they could do a protein rest there. And then so on, they go up and do an alpha and a beta amylase rest by just taking about a third out each time and boiling it. But as you can see, you're doing that three or four times in a, you know, traditionally three. It can take a long, long time to get done with your brew day. And, you know, the maltsters have kind of come out with this tricky little Malinois malt to kind of mimic that process. So, I like to use it. Some traditionalists might say that that's not the, the true way to do it, but, you know, everybody has their own dynamics they have to fit in when they do their brew days.
I mean, you only need that multi-step mash if you're using an under-modified malt, like something special, like a Moravian under-modified malt or something like that,
right? Right.
Most Pilsners nowadays are highly modified, so you could just use them in a single, do a single infusion mash, right?
Yeah, I do single infusion mashes and try to hit, you know, 150, 152, but you can do the decoction mashes with modified malt, just, you know, to try and get some of that Malinois type of flavor, but you don't have to do it for the purpose that it was intended for, which was, you know, handling the under-modified malt and getting everything you wanted out of it.
Now, hops play a significant role as well. What hops do you use for a traditional pils?
The Bohemian Pilsners is Sots. I mean, right. Czech Sots. It shouldn't be anything else if you're trying to brew a style. The German Pils category, which I think is 2B, opens up to more just noble varieties, no Hallertau, Tettinger. I've used Spalt. I really like Spalt as a Pilsner hop. And the reason I started with it was it had kind of a Hallertau type characteristic to it, but it was about double the alpha, so I could use less of it. Mm-hmm. But Tettinger, if I'm doing fairly large batches, I used to have a 20-gallon system. I would actually bitter sometimes with Magnum and just finish with the noble hops just for the flavor and aroma characteristics, but just use something nice and clean for bittering. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, with some of those noble hops these days, you're getting them at 2.6 or 3.3 or very low in the alpha range. Right. And your kettle, it's hard to get them out of the kettle. You're using so many of them to get 35 or 40 IBUs out of them.
Absolutely.
So I've done some bittering with some of the higher alpha stuff like Magnum, and I've had pretty good results with that. And then just finish with the other ones, which are really what you're tasting.
Yeah, I had a hop chemist on the other day. He was actually saying they're starting to use high alpha hops for aroma because they have unique aromas and flavors to them, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, you just got to be careful with them.
Yeah, obviously. what about American Pilsner? Would you jump over to the American hops, or would you still use?
Yeah, you can. I think you'd be fine just using the classic noble hops. But you know, some of the American derivatives like Liberty, the cluster would work fine, I think, although it tends to get a little higher in alpha. But I would still stay with the kind of spicy herbal hops and away from the citrus. IPA, pale ale style hops that are so popular these days, because they really don't fit the style. And you got to be careful with the American varieties because with the adjuncts being used in them, they don't quite have the malt backbone to balance the hops. So your hop character can come through in a much more robust manner if you're brewing the American style ones.
Right. You talked a little bit about water and the need for soft water to help accentuate the hop flavor. How do you get that soft water if you're not, I mean, most of us here in the United States are not in, not working with anything as soft as what they have over in Pilsen, Czechoslovakia.
Well, it's funny. It's kind of counterintuitive too, because, you know, Pilsners are known for their hop character. And, you know, when we're brewing IPAs and pale ales here in this country, we try and have hard water.
Right. We dump carbonate into it. Yeah.
And in some of the research I've done, you know, Pilsen water is very soft. So if you're really trying to brew like a Pilsner Raquel or something, you should start with soft water. And the easiest way to do that is find a, and I don't know how prevalent they are in other parts of the U.S., but here in the Sacramento area, we have some RO, reverse osmosis water, mm-hmm. Places we can go. You just bring, you know, a little 5-gallon, bring a better bottle with you or something, and they'll fill it up. And that pretty much strips water down to just hydrogen and oxygen. So you're starting with really, really, really soft water. And then you can add back to that, you know, maybe, I don't know, 50 parts per million or so to, you want a little bit of hardness in there and calcium, magnesium, that kind of thing. But,
right.
You know, I've also done some reading that you can brew perfectly fine Pilsners with harder water too. So, you know, I use the water here in Folsom.
And what's that profile look like?
I would, you know, without getting the details, I'd say it's medium yeah. hard. You know, we have Gecki and Saki. We have Kikkoman teriyaki sauce has come to Folsom from Japan just for the water there.
Wow.
And we're right down the street. So we occasionally get a little chlorine, depending on the type of year. And we'll just use some metabisulfate or carbon filter to remove it. Right. But I haven't really had any problem brewing Pilsner style beers. I don't really add anything to them. But that being said, if I'm doing like an IPA or a pale ale that's really hop oriented, I will harden those up for sure with some gypsum and maybe a little carbonate.
And what about the yeast? What do you recommend for yeast?
Again, you have a range here depending on the actual style of Pilsner that you're trying to brew. If you're really trying to brew the Bohemian style, I'd say the Y-Yeast 2001, their Urquell Lager, is probably the most definitive to style. Y-Labs has their, I think it's WLP 800, mm-hmm. is the Pilsen Lager, is another nice one. Y-Yeast has a 2007, which they advertise as a Pilsen Lager. I don't think it quite has as much fruit in the finish, but man, you can really go all over the place with these. You know, there's the 2035 from Y-Yeast as the American Lager. This is a little cleaner finishing. That's something I really like to play with when I do 10-gallon batches. I'll go into two carboys and, pitch two yeasts that I think are going to be quite different and, mm-hmm. and mess with them that way. And that's really the only way you're going to learn.
And which do you prefer, the cleaner flavor or the fruitier flavor? Or
I like the cleaner flavor.
Yeah, traditionally it's cleaner.
But they get a little skunky for me sometimes, I guess, if that's the right word for it. Maybe skunk's not the right word. I like a clean, a little bit of malt, some toast from the malt, and then a nice, just sharp, crisp hop finish at the end.
Because that brings out that hop finish, really, right?
Yeah.
Now, do you do any late edition hops? Do you do dry hopping, other things to bring out the aroma?
The Bohemian style, definitely. The one I did today, I added sots at 30, 20, 10, 5, and 0, and I'll dry hop when I go into my secondary fermenter with maybe an ounce and a half for 5 gallons. I don't like to go too much. They're not like IPAs. Can't quite handle the... You don't want to go too nuts on it, or all you get is grass.
Grassy flavor, yeah.
Always a risk. Yeah.
So what about fermentation? I know a lot of first-time brewers try go out and buy their Pilsner kit to make make their favorite beer and then go try and ferment it at room temperature, of course, which doesn't always turn out that well, as you can attest, I'm sure.
Yeah, and hopefully it's not their first one they try, because then they may not come back.
Yeah.
But at our shop, we really try to have a conversation with people when they pick up either a Pilsner or lager style kit. Mm-hmm. And we also do some classes around them, but, fermentation, controlling your fermentation temperature is key. For most people that equates, a chest freezer or refrigerator with an external temperature controller on it. Depending on the yeast you use, they have the different temperatures that they like, but it's anywhere from the high 40s to the low 50s. I've had some people that really wanted to do these out here in Northern California and didn't have a way to do it. And we've actually set them up with Kolsch yeast before and just tried to tell them to keep it down, under 70, 68 or 70. And it's worked okay. It doesn't give you the true... I don't think it gives you the true match to what the lager yeast do, but it's not a bad alternative for folks that can't do it. The other thing that we really encourage is kind of the poor man's temperature control is just getting yourself a little laundry tub or a bin from Home Depot that your carboy or whatever your bucket or whatever you're fermenting in will sit into, mm-hmm. and then filling it up to about the level that the wort is. And with cold water, and then getting 4 or 5 ice packs and just rotating 2 in every morning and night. And if you can do that in a room that's around 70, you can get yourself a little routine and keep it down there in the 50s. You just have to be pretty diligent about it and maybe have a wife that's willing to step in if she's at home during the day.
So you rotate it maybe twice a day or something like that?
Yeah, you might have to up the number of them that you rotate, but... with a large body, the mass that the wort and the water make together, it's very hard for that temperature to change radically over time. So if you can get it down and keep it there, it doesn't necessarily push to change very much.
So it's really a matter of monitoring it probably continuously, right?
Right. A lot of times we'll just put a attached little temperature strip on the outside of whatever the container is and keep it close.
Yeah, those are great.
But it's a good way to try it without having to spend the money on a fridge or a freezer and a temperature controller and all that kind of thing.
Right. What kind of schedule do you use with a fermentation? I know some people, they do diacetyl rests and all these other things. What do you recommend there? I mean, let's assume you get through the primary fermentation. What do you do?
Right. Next? So definitely diacetyl rest. But if I have my druthers, I like to run it down to about 40 and then pitch the yeast and let it slowly come up to the fermentation temperature for that yeast. So, let's say 48, 50 degrees. And then I'll leave it there and let it go until, I'll take some gravity readings until I feel like it's reached its terminal gravity.
So you're actually pitching the yeast at 40. Is that right? So you're cooling it, cooling it really fast up front, all the way down to 40, and then pitching the yeast and letting it rise back up to whatever the fermentation temperature is.
Right. I think that kind of limits ester production, but it's a little easier said than done. It's not that easy to get it down to 40 when our tap water here in Northern California is at like 66.
Yeah, you need a super cooler, or you got to leave it in the fridge for a while, I guess.
So. Yeah, and so that's what I end up doing is I'll put it in the cooler as soon as I can and try and get it down. That being said, I've pitched in the 60s before and kind of let it come down that way, and it seems to start a little faster that way for sure. But I tend to think the yeast gets a little stressed that way. Mm-hmm. And I think it leads to diacetyl, maybe some sulfur sometimes if you do that. So I think your beers will be cleaner if you can start them low and let them come up.
So walk us through the diacetyl rest. How does that work? So
diacetyl rest is really pretty simple. Diacetyl is a byproduct of fermentation. So, I'll just let them warm up. Once fermentation looks like it's complete and I've hit my terminal gravity, and I'll do this with my ales too. I'll let the ales sit for another day or two just at their normal fermentation temperature. Mm-hmm. But the lagers, you need to let them warm up to 65, 70 degrees. Usually just bring them into a room in the house and let them sit for 2 days, and the yeast will actually clean it up on its own.
So you actually let it sit that long, huh?
Yeah, I'll let it sit for a day or two.
And fairly high temperature. I'm surprised that most people I talk to just a few degrees, but
they'll just bump it up into maybe 58 or 60.
Yeah. I'm sort of surprised you take it that high, but it works out, right? It cleans it up.
It works out. I mean, the yeast has kind of done what it's going to do. It's not actively fermenting. So, and then from there I'll crash it, down into 36, 35, as cold as I can get it in my fermenter.
Right. And that's for the lagering, I assume, right?
Yeah, for the lagering and to get the yeast to drop. And I'll do that for 3 or 4 days, and then I'll transfer it into whatever the lagering vessel is. That's mm-hmm. just to try and get as much sediment as I can in the primary before I rack.
And so that process takes maybe, a week? And then you walk through, then you go into the storage phase, if you will?
The lagering phase, yeah. It depends on the yeast. I mean, I've had them take 2 weeks to ferment before. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're just slow and steady. Then from there, I'll let it lager. Again, it kind of depends on the, for the Pilsners, I'll let them lager for about a month and a half. I think traditionalists would say maybe even longer. I think the beer tends to age better, in a larger vessel than it does in a bottle. I mean, it's kind of the argument I get from customers sometimes is, well, why can't I just bottle it and leave it in there?
Yeah.
Can it lager in a bottle? Well, yeah, I can, but probably going to get a little more sediment in the bottle because it hasn't had time to fall out on its own in the secondary. And I tend to think that beer develops flavor better when it's conditioned with it, in a larger container.
Well, the other problem is your finished beer is still in contact with all that stuff that fell out. Whereas if you lager it, it's got a chance to you get a chance to separate it before you bottle it or keg it, right?
Right.
So how do you go about finishing the beer? Carbonation levels, how do you store it, serve it, et cetera?
I keg most of mine. I do too. So I'll roll right into a corny keg, and then, I'll put it at about 18 pounds for two or three days. That seems to give you just kind of an average, maybe a little bit above average carbonation level, which I think is perfect for that style. Any of these beers that accentuate hops, you want a decent level of carbonation in so that it can push the aroma up into your nose when it's poured into a glass.
That's why they serve them in tall glasses too, isn't it?
Right. Just kind of doesn't have, you know, have those real wide glasses where the aromas just get kind of lost. So that the skinny ones help with that. But, you know, if I'm bottling, I will bottle usually with some liquid or dry malt extract, Pilsen type, rather than corn sugar. I've just kind of gotten away from dextrose over the years.
Why is that?
I don't know. I just, it seems to me that I'd rather have my beers, I'd rather use something like a dry malt or something that's based on the actual ingredients that I already have in the beer, rather than adding something else just for carbonation. So, I'll usually use a little bit of, like Bries Pilsen dry malt extract, maybe 7.5 ounces or so, for 5 gallons, and just boil it for 2 or 3 minutes, add it to my bottling, tank or whatever I'm using, and then, rack the beer on top, and then, just go right into the bottle. If I've sat for more than a month and a half or 2 months, I'll pitch, another yeast. And, I've actually in the last couple of times I've done it when I bottle, I actually pitch an ale yeast at that point, like a real clean fermenting ale yeast, like the 01 or the 1056,
right,
from White Labs, just because I know what it'll do, and I don't have to worry with another lager yeast, and I don't know if it's a lot of it's settled out, so I'm not really relying on the yeast that did the initial fermentation.
So you actually pitch another yeast just to give it a little boost,
when just to make sure.
Yeah. Not a bad idea, really.
Again, I keg most of the time. So that's kind of in the rare case. But, nothing's worse than spending 3 or 4 months on a beer and then they're all flat when you pop the bottles open. Yeah. So it's just kind of an insurance policy.
I was wondering if you could talk for a minute just about mash temperature. We did talk quite a bit about mashing, but what do you recommend for mash temperature?
For the Bohemian style, I like to mash a little high, like 154 or so, because I really try and get, I want that really robust malt character to kind of to balance the high hopping schedule those have. I mean, some of those beers are 45 IBUs. That's pretty high for a lighter colored beer like that. So I tend to mash those a little higher. The German variants is, it should be a little drier than the Bohemian variant. So I haven't brewed that much. I mean, I think I've made one by mistake before because I hit, 148 instead of 154. So those you can mash, a little closer to the normal window, 152, 150 in there, and hence become a little drier because you're, on the lower end of the mash schedule there. And then, the American style, the Pilsners, you're using 6-row and you're using corn flakes or rice or whatever. And, sometimes you have to, heat the flakes and the maize first to kind of gelatinize them a little bit before you mash. But I would still try and hit just your normal 150 or 152 with that beer because it should be a pretty dry beer too. So it's only the Bohemian one that I would say I like to mash a little bit higher just to really make sure I get that, that ending gravity of, 12, 13, 14 even, which, sounds kind of strange, but, that's really where those beers should finish. They should be definitely above 10.
Pretty high finishing gravity, really, for the style.
Yeah.
You have one or two tips on how to get a clean finish, how to get that authentic taste out of your Pilsner?
Malt, I mean, a lot of it comes down to, excuse me, ingredients. Good base, I think malt. Starting with a genuine German European-style Pilsner malt helps a lot. I also like to acidify my mash a little bit. Mash pH is pretty tough when you're using, to keep it down.
Right.
When you're using, such light malt.
100% Pilsner malt. You don't have, you end up too high.
You end up too high. So I'll use like a half of a quarter teaspoon of lactic acid sometimes. Mm-hmm. In other beers, like pale ales, I don't have a lot of dark malt. I'll use some of the 5.2 stabilizer from Five Star, but I don't like doing that with the Pilsners because you're hardening the water a little bit.
You can affect the taste, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you're trying to do it with soft water, you're kind of nixing that right away. So a little bit of lactic acid just to kind of help keep it down, I think helps bring a little more of the malt flavor out. You know, I also think I wouldn't use American style Saaz hops either. I would really try and get the imported Czech Saaz hops.
Any other thoughts?
I think the other one would be fermentation temperature. I mean, you definitely don't want to ferment above the range for your recommended yeast.
Yeah.
That for sure will throw your flavors off. I mean, lager yeast is just so delicate in the way that it works. So, you know, I really like the going down below the range and letting it warm up. I think that's probably the, in my mind, the best way to get clean, really clean finished lager beers. Mm-hmm. And then playing with the yeast. I mean, some of them are going to leave a little more malt, maybe a little more sulfur sometimes. And, you know, that's really up to each person to kind of figure out which one they like the best.
Now, do you worry about pitch rates for the yeast? I know that, yeah. You know, for example, lager
that I meant to talk on.
Yeah. Yeah. Lager needs a lot more yeast than ale, right?
Yes, they do. For a typical 5 gallon batch, I like to make a starter, mm-hmm. or I'll pitch, you know, multiple packets. But, if I'm making a starter for an ale, a lot of times I'll grab a smack pack or a vial of White Labs and just do kind of one iteration with, you know, maybe 2 cups of extract, or I mean, a half a cup of extract and 2 cups of water. And that's enough for the ales, but the lagers, I'll double that. So, yeah. You know, I'll have maybe a full cup of extract and 4 cups of water. I'll make about a 10-30 wort. And I might actually do that twice. So I might start maybe a week, two 10 days
starter, before right?
to start the build up.
So a 2-stage starter, right? So essentially yep. you're going to make a quarter or two, and then you're going to double it again, right?
Yep. Yep. I don't think, I mean, it's very hard to have too much for some of these beers.
Yeah. Especially when you start looking at the points that you're adding, and then it turns out you need so many million cells per point. It adds up to quite a bit of yeast, really, especially for lagers.
Yeah. And the other thing I've done is I've played a little bit with the Fermentis lager yeast, and mm-hmm. I actually like those a lot. You know, they're a little cheaper normally than the liquid ones, and you can just pitch multiple packs. I've had pretty good success with the 3470, which is their kind of their Carlsberg strain. Mm-hmm. And that seems to leave you with a really malty lager or Pilsner style beer.
Now, Fermentis is a dry yeast, if I remember right.
Yeah, it
dry
is.
Dry yeast packet. Those do have advantages. They store better. And
they store better. They store longer.
They're easy to pitch because all you really got to do is hydrate them. You don't have to go through necessarily creating a big starter for them. So.
You don't, you know, and the funny thing is, we've been doing it a lot without hydrating them. We just pitch them right into the wort.
Oh, really?
And they seem to start faster that way. I mean, we've done a lot of sample batches, especially with the ale yeast from them, where we've hydrated them, you know, kind of the traditional way of starting your dry yeast mm-hmm. versus just pitching them direct. And, you know, the lag time when you hydrate them, sometimes 6 or 8 hours, where it's almost right on 3 or 4 wow. when we direct pitch them.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah. I mean, even the hydration process. Even the hydration process, usually what, 10, 15 minutes? I mean,
yeah.
Not a very long process. So I wouldn't expect you to see a big difference actually, but.
No, it's funny. And when I tell people that, they look at me like I'm crazy. A lot of times just some of these traditional homebrewers, and they were used to some of the dry yeast products from years ago. They won't even try the Fermentis products, but we've really had great success with them. You know, with our kits and stuff, especially for the beginner brewers, they're just a great way to get them started and, not quite as finicky sometimes as the liquid yeast, and also keeps our cost down.
I know when I started, dry yeast was essentially reused bread yeast, and it was not very good. But
yeah.
But I mean, it really has changed pretty dramatically over the years. The stuff we're getting now, both dry and liquid, is much higher quality than we had even a few years ago.
Yeah, and the other thing I'd say about making sure the beers are clean and what you can do, mm-hmm. oxygen or air. If you have a way to aerate your wort, it's really important with lager beers.
Do you aerate your wort right up front?
I used to, when I had a more sophisticated system. I'd actually had a stone that was in line, and I would run pure O2 on the back end of a plate chiller. So mm-hmm. I would do that. I get great results that way, but I just don't really have the sophisticated system anymore. So I ferment in a, 15-gallon Sankey keg, and I use one of the little siphon sprayers that kind of sits on the end of a racking tube that just kind of helps spray the wort as it goes in, and that helps a little, and then I shake a lot.
Any aeration is much better than none. So
yep. Just rock the keg.
Right. What about Pilsner variations? You know, close cousins to this beer, and some of the variants we hit. We talked a little bit about the American Bohemian and European style or German style, I guess.
Right. So we talked about the three styles within the Pilsner category. Mm-hmm. Those are variations. It's funny. You could kind of look at Belgian Blonde. Mm-hmm. And say that's kind of the Belgians' take on Pilsner beers, because the malt bills are pretty darn similar unless you're adding, sugars and things like that. But right. Belgian Pilsner and German Pilsner are really similar in spec. And that's something I've done before, is, made 10-gallon batches and pitched, like a Trappist or an Belgian-style yeast on half, and then pitched the lager yeast on the other, and obviously fermented them in different environments. But it's pretty amazing to taste the two beers when you're done and understand the flavor attributes that come from the Belgian yeast, and how much the yeast has to do with flavor profile of those beers.
It is excellent. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add, Eric?
I don't think so. I think we've really covered it pretty well. I went through my whole brew process, and I don't think there's anything we really didn't cover.
We got a minute or two left. Do you want to talk a little bit about your new shop and your new website?
Sure. Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity.
Sure.
We've been in the Sacramento area since 1991, and I bought the store in 2004 because I was kind of disappointed in my local homebrew shop. So We've expanded to two stores now. So we have two brick and mortar stores, kind of one on the southwest side of Sacramento and the other on the, southeast, and then one on the northeast side of Sacramento in Folsom and Roseville. Mm-hmm. And then we've also rolled out a new website. That's
shopbrewmeister.com.
Shopbrewmeister.com. Thank you. And I wouldn't say all of our products are up there yet, but I think we're pretty price competitive with some of the big boys out there. We're certainly not a Northern Brewer or a Midwest Supply, one of those guys, but we pride ourselves on service and a lot of advice. We really look to become kind of a consultant with our home brewers. We don't want them to be confused or feel intimidated when they come in the store. We really want to help them achieve what their goals are as a home brewer, and everybody's different. So we really take a consultative approach to folks when they visit the store, and as much as we can on email and stuff when we're interacting, over the web.
I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show, and thanks for teaching me a little bit more about Pilsners.
You're welcome.
Once again, that was Eric Schmidt. He is the brewmeister with homebrew shop locations at Folsom, California and Roseville, California. And you can find him online again at shopbrewmeister.com. Well, I'd like to give a big thank you to Eric Schmidt for that outstanding interview. If you had feedback for the show, you can go to beersmith.com/form or beersmith.com/blog and leave a note under this episode. Also want to remind you one more time, our new website, beersmithrecipes.com. There's over a thousand recipes there you can visit now and search. And also the new version of Beersmith, Beersmith 2.1, is out. Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.